You're listening to EAA Radio, and I'm Digital Dave. And on the phone with me today is Mr. Lance Geiger, otherwise known as the History Guy. How you doing today, Lance?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Great. What kind of a story do you have for us today?
Today we're going to talk about one of the most exciting planes in history. And if you're an aviation lover, almost everybody, it's one of their favorite planes. It's the SR-71 Blackbird, which was, of course, an extraordinary reconnaissance aircraft.
Yep. It's mean just sitting on the ground.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's a beauty in any which way. People still flock to see the ones that are left, and it's as extreme as an airplane will ever be.
Right. Now, what's this story about?
Well, this is about one of the times that we lost an SR-71. There were actually 12 of the 12 lost accidents. So it was a dangerous plane to fly, but only in one of those accidents did they lose a crew member in a flight accident. But that is an extraordinary incident, and it's an extraordinary incident of survival, too. But it's when the SR-71 was still in the testing phase, and it was in, let me make sure I get the date right here, January of 1966,
okay.
And the January 25th. And one of the things that they were doing is they were seeing if they get better fuel efficiency if they were to shift the center of gravity. So this plane was configured to have the center of gravity a little farther back than it usually would be. And of course, it's early for the SR-71. And one of the things about that is that the engines, you got the air is coming in faster, that so fast that it's faster than the jet engine can actually heat the air and put it out the back. So
right.
It uses a special nose cone in order to slow the airflow into the engine. And occasionally that would get something called a blowback and inlet unstart, it was called. And it would blow back air from backwards out of the engine the wrong direction, and it would shut off the afterburner. And of course, then you've got a lot of asymmetric thrust with the other engine. And those unstarts, they were uncommon, but they would happen. All the pilots were trained for them, but it was exciting when that would happen. They described that as like being in a train wreck as the plane was shaking and bouncing, and then the computer and the pilot would get back control, the engine back in control, and then we get back to normal flight status. So
okay.
they were a known issue, and they would happen more on the earlier ones because the computer that controlled the inlet cones was an analog computer, was an early analog computer. And later on, they were able to put in a much better computer that gave much better control. But of course, on a plane that goes as fast and as high as the SR-71, there's only so much a pilot can do. You really have to have mechanical stuff that's happening to put all the pieces together to keep that in flight. And those mechanical pieces of the computers were a lot less powerful in the early ones. So in 1966, flying the plane was a strange configuration. And Bill Weaver was the pilot. He was a famous test pilot for Lockheed. And then Jim Zweier was a flight reconnaissance specialist. And they were testing whether they could get a little bit more fuel efficiency out of the plane. And part of the problem with the SR-71 is that to go the distances it needed to go, the fuel was pretty heavy. And in fact, they wouldn't even take off with a full fuel load. They would take off with just enough gas to take off, and they would immediately get in air refueling. And
okay.
So they were really trying to figure out the best way to get the fuel efficiency out of the plane.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty mundane flight.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, it was a test flight. I don't think any flight in an SR-71 is mundane.
Yeah, that's probably true.
They're coming so fast. But it was, I mean, they weren't thinking of this as being an extraordinary flight, and it wasn't a mission. It was a test. So they weren't flying over Russia to see whether they were building rockets or anything like that. They were really just, trying to do a sort of a routine test to see if they could, by shifting where they carried the fuel load, if they could shift the center of gravity, if they would get a little bit of fuel efficiency out of it. And so it wasn't anything that was expected to be an extraordinary test now.
Okay. So it starts out as usual, and then?
Mm-hmm. Well, and then they're just turning the plane. It's a planned turn, but I mean, of course, banking an SR-71 is going to be an experience because it's going Mach 3. So they're at 10,000 feet. They're at the edge of space, and they're banking the plane. And as he banks the plane, he gets an inset unstart.
Okay.
And so when you combine just what was going on, the fact that it was banking, the fact that the center of gravity had been moved, and that gave it a little bit less lateral stability, and then you have an unstart at that time. And they had already been having trouble with that computer, which is fairly common, but they've been having trouble with the computer that controlled the nose cone on that side. When all three of those came together, it simply exceeded the ability of the aircraft's control system and the pilot to be able to keep control of the aircraft. And so at those speeds, you know, there's not much that can happen that's going to save that aircraft. It just disintegrated in midair, 10,000 feet. above, and these two guys are in it, and they weren't able to eject or anything. He's trying to, what he wanted to do was to get it down to an altitude where you could eject safely, but you couldn't even understand him. They're going so fast that his voice into the radio is just garbled. The plane's going faster than the speed of sound.
Right.
And so they couldn't communicate. They couldn't, and the plane just, it was at such high G-force that they were both passed out when the plane came apart.
Wow. And so, he woke up falling? He woke up free falling.
Yeah, he woke up. He says the first thing when he woke up was he's trying to figure out, that no one could have lived through that. So I must be dead. This must be what it means to be dead.
Wow.
Was his first thought. They wear a pressure suit. And, of course, if you didn't have a pressure suit at the altitudes that they go, it would be fatal here. I mean, literally your saliva boils on your tongue.
Yeah.
And your blood doesn't literally boil above the Armstrong limit, but you cannot keep blood pressure and you die.
Right.
So his suit managed to, with the plane tearing up apart from him, he wasn't in the ejection seat. The ejection seat was still with the parts of the plane. It had torn through the heavy nylon straps. And somehow his suit stayed together and stayed pressurized. It's got an oxygen tank built to it, stayed pressurized, which it's supposed to do, which was absolutely amazing given the violence of the breakup. So he, of course, and you've got a long free fall from 10,000 feet. So he doesn't know how far he fell before he woke up. But then he wakes up and he says, maybe I'm dead. And then he realizes he hears these flaps flapping in the wind. He says, well, I don't imagine you're going to hear that when you're dead. So he figures out that he is falling, free falling, but he doesn't know if all the automatic parts of the suit are going to work right that are supposed to deploy his parachutes.
Okay, so the suit had its own parachute.
It did. The suit had a built-on parachute, and those were built so that they should be automatically releasing. He shouldn't have to do anything. But, of course, when the plane's torn apart and you're not even in your ejection seat, he has no idea if that's going to work the way it's supposed to.
Wow. So he's just basically waiting to splat.
Yeah, waiting to splat. He's trying to find the controls, but his hands are so cold and the suit is so bulky, he can't find anything. So essentially, yes, he's waiting. He figured out that he's alive, but he doesn't know if he's going to be alive for very long because, you hit the ground, you hit the ground. So he's just kind of hoping that the parachutes work the way they should. They did. It first puts out a small chute that controls the spin, because otherwise you can spin so quickly falling that far that it actually could kill you.
Yeah.
So the first chute controlled the spin, and the second chute opened like it should, which he had no idea if that was going to work or not. And it did. He can imagine his surprise at not being dead, and he could see the wreckage of the plane, and he could actually see the other chute, too. He could see Zweier's chute, so he was happy to see that the other guy had made it out as well.
But the other guy did not survive.
Did not survive. It turns out his chute worked the way it was supposed to and everything, but it turns out apparently his neck was broken by the violence of the crash. He died before he was out of the plane.
Wow. Wow. So he comes down intact, lands on the ground, and he's like, oh, my God, I can't believe I survived that.
But he doesn't even know what state he's in.
Right.
So it's somewhere over the American Southwest. He could be in Mexico. It could be in Texas. Turns out he was in New Mexico, but he didn't know that. And he figures it's going to be awfully hard for them to find him. So he figures wherever I land, I'm going to have to figure out how to live through the night, and because it could get very cold at night.
Yeah.
And when he's landing, actually, he said he almost landed on an antelope, because he's looking down at this very surprised antelope, and it was trying to figure out what he was, and it apparently took it a while to process that, and it only ran away as they almost hit it.
That's typical.
But he's on the ground, and he's alive. He's happy to be alive, but he doesn't know where he is. He doesn't know if they know where he is. He doesn't know if they know he's alive. His helmet was actually broken so that the visor, the latch that holds the visor up was broken. So he's with one hand holding his visor up. With the other hand, he's trying to pat down his chute so it doesn't start blowing around in the wind. He doesn't know how long before anybody's going to find him. And someone behind him says, can I help you with that?
Oh, wow.
Now that fast.
It wasn't the antelope.
It was the antelope talking to him. It turns out that they crashed over a ranch in New Mexico, that the rancher happened to own a little Bell helicopter, and that they saw the parachutes coming down. So he'd hopped in the helicopter and flown over to him right away. So almost as soon as he landed, he had someone there to help him.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's a great end to a really crappy day.
Yeah, to have someone there with you. Well, except that then the pilot flew over to where the other chute was, and then he found out that Zweier was dead, that the person with him had died in the accident. So I'm sure he was very happy to be alive, but it was still a tragic day. It was the only loss due to flight accident of an SR-71 crew member.
Wow. And then, of course, the Air Force had to go find all the pieces because that thing was still classified at that point.
Oh, absolutely. You don't want anybody to find any PC or SR-71. But, you know, luckily it was in New Mexico. It wasn't over, you know, it wasn't over Russia or anything like that.
Or Chicago.
Or Chicago. Yeah, it didn't. It was if it killed another antelope, they never found it. So, yeah, luckily it was over such sparse territory. Didn't do any damage, didn't hurt anyone, and you know, they didn't have to, you know, recover the wreckage from some sort of dangerous place.
Wow.
But the funny part at the end of the story is that the guy's flying him to the hospital in his little helicopter, and he's looking, and the guy's got the helicopter pegged past the red line. So he's still, hey, there's no hurry. But this rancher is apparently very excited that he gets to do something in his helicopter, and so he's trying to get him to the hospital. So he's thinking, you know, how interesting it would be, how ironic, if I survived falling out of an SR-71 at 10,000 feet and then died in the helicopter on the way to the hospital.
Right, right. That would be, yes, terrible.
That would have been bad. But he made it back okay. And eventually, Billy was famous. Eventually, he became the chief test pilot for the SR-71 and for Lockheed. And as far as I know, as far as I can tell from the research, he's still alive. He lives in California.
Wow. I imagine the first thing he did was said, we got to fix this unstart problem.
Yeah, we got to. The first thing they made some aerodynamic changes. But the first thing was, since the unstart problem was going to persist, was that they never flew again with that so that the center of gravity was too far back. Because it was that loss of stability that was the reason that you couldn't recover from an unstart.
Oh, okay.
But they did, as they came up with better computers, then they were able to pretty much eliminate that unstart problem.
All right, that's a fantastic. That's a fascinating story. You've got a million of them. Where I can find you at History Guy on YouTube, correct?
On YouTube, yep.
All right, Lance, I want to thank you very much for joining us. I could talk for another 4 days, but I'll let you go.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yep, this is Digital Dave, and you're listening to EAA Radio.